Right. Good afternoon, everybody. Apologies for starting a few minutes late, but I'm now even more pleased that I asked you all to do your homework beforehand. So this session is going to be drawing on a piece of work that I did along with Colin and a couple of other researchers.
I'm going to reveal
some of the insights from that particular piece of work after I've got you to do your interactive activity. And I'll also tell you how the interactive activity should have worked in the event that it doesn't come up with what I think it's going to. So hopefully you all have a image of what you understand the Cold War to be or to have been. Or you can quickly Google and download a picture, or you can imagine one very vividly in your mind. And I'm going to get you to think very particularly about that particular activity. And the next thing I want you to do is, on your own and without conferring with anybody, I want you to imagine that you are the Foreign Minister, the Secretary of State, or the Foreign Secretary for the place where you were born, but do not reveal where that was. And for the purposes of this session, Cornwall is not an independent state. It's up to you as to whether Scotland is. But please do not reveal that at any point during this particular activity. And I want you to write a singular policy based on the image or the picture of the Cold War that you have, that you think your Foreign Minister, Secretary of State, or Foreign Secretary should adopt as their chief and primary priority. Now, within that, you need to determine what date you think it is, what phase of the Cold War we're in, if there was a phase, if you think your policy bridges over the entire period that you have in mind as being the Cold War. And you need to be as particular as you possibly can. And I'm just going to give you about 3 minutes to write down your policy. If you don't want to write it down because you can't write it quickly, that's fine, just as long as you have it in your mind as to what that policy is that is going to address at least some aspect of the picture that you have drawn or downloaded or created.
Do you want it in the chat, Kath, or just on our own?
Don't reveal it to anybody.
I can check if you'd really like to. Okay.
So do not reveal your picture or the image that you've shown to anybody. Don't reveal the country or the place that you were born. Don't reveal the time. But in a minute when I put you into breakout groups, you will need to talk about these other things. 1 minute left to come up with your policy. And if you can raise your golden paw once you have written your policy so that I know everybody is done. And your golden paw is your raised hand button. Okay, that's almost everybody done. So the next part of the activity is a little bit complicated. I'm going to put you into breakout rooms. There'll be 2 to 3 people per breakout room. And you can reveal the policy that you have to the other people in the breakout room, but you must not tell them any of the contents of your image, so where that policy has come from or why you think it is the most important. And you also can't tell them the country or place where you were born, so you can't give them any of the background detail as to why you think this policy is the best one to follow. But somehow you need to create a singular policy from the group that you are in. So you need to negotiate using other means in order to come up with a single policy for your group. And some of you will find this very easy, and some of you might find this very difficult. But there'll be about 5 breakout rooms. I will be hopping in and out of all of them just to make sure that everybody's on task. And you're going to have about 6 minutes to negotiate a very, very straightforward common policy. If you fail to do that, you just need to report back that you found it impossible to come up with a singular policy without revealing any of the information that's sitting behind why you've determined that policy. Does that make sense? So I'm going to put you into breakout rooms. It will take a few minutes and you'll be automatically sucked into your breakout room. So very quickly, how did all of you find that? Did you come to a solution very quickly or did you find it problematic?
Piece of cake. Okay.
If I could go to Graham, I think you were in room one.
Yes, Terry's going to do our talking, so I'll hand over to Terry if that's okay.
I think we found it reasonably easy to come to a common policy, starting from different viewpoints.
Okay.
And from my point of view, at least, with an extremely prejudiced viewpoint on one of Graham's thoughts. But do you want to tell you what the policy was?
No, you don't have to. It's just how easy or difficult was it for you to find a common ground? So we're going to...
Reasonably easy.
Okay. I think, Colin, you were in room two?
Yeah, that's correct, and I've been nominated to speak. I think we were all very agreeable. We had three quite separate things, but we all were very agreeable on one of the main issues. So I'm not sure realistically how realistic that is, but we quickly agreed a common policy, bringing together three separate items. Mm-hmm. Over.
Okay, and Mike was in room three.
So there were just two of us. I think we started with some quite different ideas of the sort of activities we think would be compatible with our policy, but we quite rapidly got to the point where we recognised that the objective underlying those were quite similar, so we agreed on the ends of the strategy, if not necessarily the ways and the means.
Okay, and I think Evan and Stephen were in another room.
Evan's up.
It was relatively simple for us to come to an agreement because the end point of all of our policies was basically the same thing, just very, very different means in terms of scope and scale.
And Matsura and I think possibly Edward was another group.
Matsura Kaff was with us.
I'm in the Collins group. So.
And Edward.
Edward's doing tech stuff.
No, I'm here. I suppose I better speak because my partner didn't have a microphone, so we were reliant on text, which I think in its own way made formulating our policy slightly awkward. But I think we got somewhere. I think it was sort of more a difference in. Level of approach that our policies were formatted or formulated around, but if you've sort of took one as a subsidiary to the other, I think it sort of followed.
Okay. So that's interesting because I've done this activity multiple times with multiple groups of students, but I've also done this down the pub as the best place to do things. One of the pictures from down the pub was a snowman being bombed. And it came up with the policy of don't bomb snowmen as the collective agreed upon policy arrived at by bribery and corruption as to who was buying the next round as to which policy got adopted. And it's quite interesting to see how different groups either come to a collective policy very quickly or can't find a solution at all or go to a lowest common denominator of finding that agreement. And why I think this is particularly interesting and useful for games is this concept of background knowledge. So I first came across this in relation to teaching and making teaching a lot more accessible and resonant with students, especially when you've got different and diverse groups of students that maybe have different mental images in their minds as to what the Cold War was. So one of the groups of students I played this with drew me a picture of Stalin and Mao swimming. And therefore their whole approach to the Cold War didn't include anything like bombs or walls or iron curtains. It was a completely different view. So when they had to come up with a policy, it was completely irreconcilable with some policies from students who maybe have a very westernized view of the Cold War. But the idea behind background knowledge is that it's supposed to, by engaging it and by collecting together all of these triggers and different approaches to assumptions of what different terms mean, it's supposed to make whatever you learn or the experience you have even more engaging and embedded within your existing schema of knowledge. But possibly for many of you, background knowledge shouldn't just sit within teaching as an experience, and I think this is where it's particularly fascinating. A lot of Chinese scholars, particularly Qin Ya Qin, adopts this idea of background knowledge as being fundamentally misleading to understanding things like Chinese approaches to strategy and foreign policy. So in this quote, KLP is keeping a low profile. SFA is striving for achievement. And what Qin Ya Qin argues in this text and the full reference, which is an open source, an open access journal article, the full reference is at the back of my slides, is basically an assumption that because Chinese people have a different assumption background knowledge, they do not think or act in the same way as we would anticipate them. And therefore, all of our predictions for how China would respond in relative foreign policies, in response to various triggers, would be very different. And therefore, that background knowledge, and this is the bottom of this quote, plays a significant role in strategy and actor designs and takes. And therefore, it becomes fundamental in playing a game, whether you're trying to create an adversary or an ally, to understand not only the initial policy positions, but also the background knowledge of where that derives from. And that can play out in many different ways. And in particular, I think it informs knowledge creating games, but especially if you're thinking about creating a game that frames a strategy versus makes a strategy versus tests a strategy. The different ways that you might want to trigger or involve background knowledge might be different across all of these different types of knowledge that you might seek to generate. But similarly, there might be occasions where you don't actually want to generate background knowledge. You just want the people in your game to be running from the vignettes and other prompts that you have provided them. You may not want them to be drawing on background knowledge because it might disrupt what you're trying to do. So there is an initial question as to whether you actually want people to be primed to use what they know in the background, or whether you want them to be closed books in relation to the game that you're playing. And just because you want it doesn't mean that it's always going to be present. One of the things that we found out with this particular piece of research is just because we wanted certain elements of people's background knowledge to inform how they played different games didn't mean that it happened. And you might also want to think about whether you can build in background knowledge differences within the design team, within the players, within the adjudication, within the data capture, and within the reporting.
I've started Perry Jago's meeting.
And exactly, if you put it in terms of different background knowledges in the design, how do you make sure that that effect is maintained through all of these other loops in which you're going through in the game process? And one thing that's particularly interesting is you all came up with singular policies from your little group discussions. But my assumption, and I could be wrong, is that there was probably more useful, juicy bits of knowledge and nuggets of information that came out in your discussion that is not captured anywhere in what you've fed back to us, but would be quite useful as a data point to capture in and within games. Whereas if you've got somebody observing a game and taking notes, they are filtering through their own background knowledge what is and what is not important. So I will pass on the slides to Graham and Colin, and you've got the links and the references that have been used in those few slides. But I think we've got all of a minute before I explode into small pieces. So any questions that can be sorted out within less than a minute?
Well, that's because